system, what you believe about politics, what you believe about the future of the nation, what you believe about yourself, what you believe about your partner, you eventually even begin to move beyond that, and you get to see that in operation. And eventually you might see your history and how your history moved through time and you're ascending, and then eventually you get to the place where you're really kind of above the planet in a way, and then maybe even yourself dissolves, your sense of I, who you are, your ego, or however you want to think about that, dissolves, and you are one with the light. And you have that mystical kind of experience. And it is wonderful to have that kind of experience, to feel the relief of all that captivity that we wrap around ourselves and our beliefs and our worries and our concerns, and then to let that go and ultimately dissolve into the universe. And as you find that, it's an ascension, if you climb to the top of the mountain, I've made it to the mountaintop, and those kind of, and it's a wonderful thing and something that I think we ought to practice. However, in Western civilization, Earth spirituality hasn't been the predominant spirituality. You haven't heard that term often. And so that's kind of a new phrase for me in the last several years, seventh principle and environmentalism, but Earth spirituality. So Helen and I, we built a deck in the back of our son's land and put a tent on it. We've been sleeping in this tent for 6 weeks, so I've been pondering Earth spirituality in this series of sermons, and it's been very pleasant. Well, not, it's kind of camping. It's a 14 or 16 deck, and we got a big tent, and we've got 6 inches of memory foam, 2 more inches of memory foam. We got that, but we're not suffering. It's been nice. We're not sunsetting. I'm looking at trees and blue. I mean, it's just wonderful. So I was sitting on, and we got a little porch. We got a cover and a table, and I get electricity. I can get access to my computer, so we're not, it's not too friendly. So I'm sitting up there. It's a beautiful night. It's just wonderful at night. It's like the Milky Way is just right down. I mean, it's just, you can see why the ascension mystic would happen. But something happened to me pondering about Earth spirituality. So I'm sitting there, and I understand kind of the formation of chakras and that there's a crown chakra at the top of the mind, and your mind opens up to the universe, and it comes in, and there's an exchange of energy, and it's a wonderful thing. But something happened to me, so I'm kind of pondering about that. And we've got these daisies. I guess they are black-eyed sweet daisies, kind of sitting out there, beautiful yellow color. And as I close, I was watching those, and then I closed my eyes. And as the poet said at the turn of the century, loose your mind, let your mind be loose. And when I closed my eyes, that flower came up off that stem through the air and came into that seventh chakra, or crown, or however you want to think about that, my mind, and it began to slowly move through my body. And it was like being washed. It was wonderful. And I just, no thought, it was just happening, and it was great. And then as it got down to my feet, it lifted me upside down. Now, at first, I would think I'd be anxious, but I wasn't. And then it moved me over to where it came from. So here I am dangling upside down, right? And it moved me in, and then it began to lower me into the stem. And my spirit began to move through the stem. And my spirit began to move through the roots. And I began to move through the roots of the earth. And I thought, wow, this is great. It was really a wonderful, wonderful experience. Now, in my world, I have this experience. Now, and I'm going to go get all the chakra colors, and I'm going to do it with every one of them. So, but that's more contrived. But this just spontaneously occurred. But now, when I think of mysticism, I think of the ascension, and I think of the top of the mountain, and I think of moving out and seeing belief systems and all that, freeing myself from cultural captivity. But now I have a balance that I did not have before. I really did not. not, as much as I would say I did prior to the experience, I'd say, sure, you know, we're digging in the dirt, planting, making a garden and all that. I'd say, sure, but I really did not have the same kind of balance that the ascension and also the moving into the earth and experiencing life from the roots of the earth, not just the outside of the universe. It's a wonderful experience. And I'm saying it because you don't know what's going to happen to you when you begin this journey, when you start shifting frames. You can say Christian spirituality, Buddhist spirituality, Hindu spirituality, whatever you want to say. When you say earth spirituality, that's different. You don't know what's going to happen. But I am confident that whatever happens is going to be good. Because the earth is us. We are the earth. Reading one of the rights of nature books called Wild Law, and this fellow is making the point. He says we're not on the earth. We don't walk on the earth. He said we are in the earth. We're in it. The atmosphere isn't something other than the earth. The atmosphere is part of the earth, and that when we move through an aspect of the earth. We move through the atmosphere of the Earth. When the astronauts described the planet from the moon and outer space, they didn't say, oh, there's the atmosphere and there's the Earth. They said, there's the Earth. You know, the atmosphere is only 10 miles thick. It's not infinite. We protect it, take care of it. You know, it's like our home, our planet. So, and that was a new frame for me, that I am part of the flesh of the Earth. I am part of the skin of the earth, just as my skin is part of me. I'm part of that. So when you move to earth spirituality, you never know what your mind's going to do. This is the third part of a three-part sermon series. In the first part, we talked about the responsibility from our faith ancestor, William Ellery Channing, of self-formation and reflection on our history, which is kind of a mystical process in itself. You come out and reflect on your history, so you get a little separation from yourself, and you look at the patterns of your life. And in the second sermon, we talked about how to protect that mind, how to protect ourselves, how to protect our imaginations, how to protect our self-beliefs, how to protect who we are as human beings and create space for us so that we can work with ourselves. And then we also talked about, you looked at the notes, and we can talk about it a bit later, how we live in a culture, which I think you've expressed a concern about that, how there's pressure on our minds and our imagination to collapse that space in which we're free. It pushes in on us. So we have a faith tradition that says push out and create a free space for you to do the self-talk, for you to do the reflecting, for you to have a community that does that. And if I think, you know, Caring Universe is one of our highest callings, it is to create that space where people can come in and reflect and to have that through time. That's important. But we live in a culture that pushes against that and collapses that space. And so I think there are high callings, and when we look at our faith history, we can say yes to that, but we do get to a point where we need to say, now what? Now what? What do we do now? What do we do that we have this wonderful faith tradition that doesn't clothe us in historical clothing and capture our spirits and create a space for us to exist, but we can't go out of that space in thought or body or mind, but says, no, go explore the universe. You can have that mystical experience, whether it's in the universe or whether it's in the dirt. And it's okay to play with the idea of earth spirituality, knowing that you may change. So now what? So here's an idea of that. Now what? So theology, many people, theology, what is that, right? Theology, it's very important to understand something about theology. Theology is not a set of beliefs. It's not, I believe this, theologically, I believe this. Theology is an action. And the action of theology is to listen to the voice of the suffering. That's the job of theology, to listen to the voice despise the voice of the suffering. Now we have obvious voices where there's suffering, where there's wars, where there are children, where immigration, the wave of immigration coming in, people looking for work, looking for a better way of life, and have children. We hear the cries, we hear that suffering. We hear the financial people who have been, I would say, victimized financially, but somebody else might call that use a different frame. But nonetheless, people are suffering financially. We hear those voices, and so we look theologically. We look at, and there's some voices of suffering that are not so obvious. The people have been victimized as children in some way, shape, or form. They lose their voice. They dissociate, go into a sense of silence. We don't feel important enough to have our voice. You're concerned, where's our voice going to be heard? I have this idea, where's my voice going to be heard? You know, the not so obvious suffering, the person who silently struggles with addiction and is over here lives a life, but over here leads this life, and that they're struggling with this addiction, but you never see and you never hear about it because people are embarrassed or they're hiding or whatever. We don't hear that voice of suffering, but it is the responsibility of the theologically minded people to find those voices of the suffering. With earth spirituality, it's just not the human voice we want to search out and find. It's also the voice of the earth, the voice of all participants of this wonderful plan. Because in earth spirituality, the human is not the center. The plant is more the center. The whole is more the center. So we must consider it all. So theology doesn't stop there. Theology works to find and hear that voice. Then theology has an obligation to offer comfort in the suffering and healing. But it doesn't stop there. Then the responsibility of the theologically minded people moves toward transforming the patterns and the systems that cause the suffering. It's not enough to offer comfort. We need to do that. We need to be about that, whether that's through counseling, whether that's through pastoral care, whether that's through sitting with somebody, whether that's through, we know, Fred Wolf in the hospital from the Stratford Church. We know that. We know there's a suffering there, and we move in that direction to say we know, we acknowledge the suffering. We acknowledge the victimization. You know, when you're working with families and there has been victimization of childhood sexual abuse, say, I know it's extremely important for that victim to know that somebody understands what they've been through. To have a witness to your life. To share that, not to live in isolation. So theology hears the voice and begins to work to transform the cultural patterns that have cause the suffering. That's where we get in trouble as people. Okay. A lot of spiritual activity on creating counseling, creating different kind of things to heal the suffering, and we do that. But then to actually put a voice to the patterns that cause the suffering, we get a lot of argument because a lot of us benefit from patterns that cause suffering. That's what makes it difficult. But I tell you, we've been living in a tent, and it's been absolutely wonderful. Now, if it's minus 20, I don't know. We don't have to have so many things and possessions that we would say, if I didn't have them, I'd be suffering. So maybe the suffering is different. So, quote from Thomas Berry about earth spirituality. First, a poem, and I love this poem, by Denise Levertov, helps express how we get our mind moving. But we have only begun to love the earth. We have only begun to imagine the fullness of life. How could we tire of hope? So much is in the bud. We have yet to begin to love the earth. only begun to love the earth. What is it like? What was it like for you when you first fell in love? I was blinded, you know. I could see nothing else, you know. And that happens to us when people fall in love. That our emotional world somehow opens up and we intertwine and become one, because what we're doing is we're building a foundation. If it's love, we're building a foundation that's going to see us through time and see us through difficult times. I mean, sometimes if you didn't love the person, you might have said in your mind, I wouldn't be here. So that love is excruciatingly important to have a strong foundation. But then it gives life. When you look back on your life, somebody who loved and you can tell the story and laugh, it's just wonderful. We have just begun to love the earth. It is the beginning of a love story from this poem. We've just begun. Look what we have to look forward to. Earth spirituality. The spirituality of the earth refers to a quality of the earth itself, not a human spirituality with special reference to the planet earth. Maybe we Unitarian Universalists could fall into that trap with our seventh principle. We have, this is our seventh principle, so it's kind of out here, it's our principle. Thomas Berry says, no. The spirituality of the earth refers to a quality of the earth itself, not a human spirituality with a special reference to the planet earth. Earth is the material principle out of which we are all born and from which we derive all that we are and all that we have. We come into being in and through the earth. Simply put, we're earthlings. The earth is our origin, our nourishment, our educator, our healer, our fulfillment. At its core, even our spirituality is derived from the earth. The human and the earth are totally implicated in each other. If there is no spirituality in the earth, then there is no spirituality in ourselves. From that perspective, spirituality comes before the human being. I'd like to say, and I'm working on solidifying this in my mind. Hi, my name is Gregory Wilson, and I am 13.7 billion and 57 years old. I am. Now, I know my 57-year-old birth story well, the ones I've been told and believe to be true, up to a certain age. Of course, then when I tell my own story, I have learned that sometimes that's a little distorted. Okay, but do I know my 13.7 billion-year-old story? And when you do spiritual work, and the clinical training I've been in, they want us to write our birth story. What was going on in your life before you were born? What was going on in your life when you were born? What was going on in the first 3 years of your life? Because that's important. Well, if we're doing that mystical exercise of backing up and looking at who we are as a being, it's just as important that we know the birth story 13.7 billion years ago. We need to know that story to fully understand who we are and what we are. If I only know a small portion of that, now, and I was born into a process that has the spirituality moving, I was born into that process and joined up with that spirituality already ongoing. That makes it wonderful and special in some ways, but doesn't make it narcissistically special, where it's centered on me. I got saved on this day. How wonderful life began at this day. Everything revolves around that day. See, that makes it all about me. No, I joined a process that was already moving through time, and I've become part of a process that was already moving through time. My spirituality is here before me. And Thomas Berry continues and says, as he observes this movement that I was born into, what he would say about that movement, there are three underlying principles that describe that process that's moving. The first one is differentiation. And what he means by that is there is a wonderful variety of things and stuff and beings and particles and planets that's going on. And when I learned my whole story, the best that I know, and he makes another point. He says, because of the science we have now, we human beings can know our full story better than any human beings that ever lived before. Barring there were civilizations that died out and more civilizations that died, barring that. But we know more. 500 years ago, they wouldn't talk about supernovas, cooking particles, and then when the supernova exploded, particles moving out and eventually coming together and forming galaxies, planets, and solar systems. But we know that. We are literally stardust. Differentiation, the variety, he says that is part of the movement of the universe. The second one is subjectivity. And in subjectivity, he says there does seem to be a self, using that word self, it's complicated, but a self-organizing principle. And when you think, wait a minute, how can the universe be self-organizing? Because most often, in my history, we objectify and observe the universe, the stars, the sun, the moon, and it's not really life, it's inorganic, it's not life, and we objectify it, these objects out here, right? He says, no, there's something, even in as the rocks interact with the world, rocks are in us, but the rocks interact, that there's a self-organizing process, and I'm thinking there must be something to it because I'm here. There must be something to it because here's the Earth, here's the Moon, critical role in the Earth, in the life of the Earth, and here's the Sun, and here's the solar system, and it's moving in an order, there's an order to it. How did that happen? He said there's a self-organizing process going on. And thirdly, he said, on that substructure of it all, there is this sense of communion, which in, say, communion church, kind of loaded, but he does something different with that. He says, the communion is everything is related. We are learning that. Some are saying that the rainforest is related to the coral reefs, is related to the Florida Everglades. Some would even say that somehow the smokestacks in Illinois are related to the mercury in the fish in New England. Everything is related. So when one thing happens, it has an effect and it ripples out. There is no hyper-individualism. There is no separation from that. There is no I'm other than the Earth. There is no I'm other than the Moon. We are all somehow part and one and in relationship. You get some of that flavoring in the human community from the New Testament. When Paul's talking about when one part of the body hurts, the whole part of the body hurts. You see windows into that in the spiritual writing. Somebody in this congregation is sick and is hurting, and empathy moves, and we move, so it's there. We do see it. So those three principles, the differentiation, the communion, the subjectivity, are crucial to his understanding of Earth spirituality. Then he says, there are rights. And that's where people go, wait a minute, how can nature have rights? How can that river have rights? We can do with that river what we want. Well, we've been doing that for 500 years and it's not really working that well for us. But, so there's these people arguing for rights. And here's what he says about rights. Coming out of that foundation, the three principles, kind of substrate foundation, he says that there are three rights. If you exist, you have a right to be. When I look back at history, there have been moments in time where human beings have said to other human beings, you don't have a right to exist. We've done things with animals that say, you don't have a right to exist. We've done that with trees. The healthy life of a river. You know, after World War II, we labeled some rivers industrial rivers. Once you label a river an industrial river, life is going to leave. And it has, if you go look at an industrial river. Dead. There's 400 dead zones. Water fines on this planet. 400, and it's increasing and getting intenser and getting bigger. And we continue the same patterns that produce them. I mean, I'm not making that up. You have a right to be. I go down to Eli Copper Mine, and someone bites back in the woods, and it's still dead places. You know, so I don't know how many dead earth places. I don't know how many dead sea places. We report that. That earth, wherever there is a mind, you have a right to be. Second, you have a right to the habitat that was there from which you emerged. If you needed clean water, clean air, healthy dirt, trees, animals, if you needed that to somehow self-organize and come together so that you emerged, you have a right to that habitat. Not to be poisoned, not to be polluted, not to be ruined, not to be eliminated, not to be paved over. I don't know where would we take that? You have a right to that. And thirdly, you have a right to fulfill what is the natural divine unfolding of who you are and what you are. So I'm thinking, right, my father was union guy, district director in steelworking, so I'm aware of the union. One thing he was most proud of in his life was that none of his children punched time clocks. Well, I've punched some time clocks in my life, but that's what he's, and I was thinking about that. If I'm punching a time clock, am I unfolding in my natural way? Did I come into existence? And as I'm unfolding in my existence, punching the time clock, is that affirming my life? That's a fair question. Since we've created culture, even if I don't punch the time clock, I'm getting up by that alarm clock this many hours here. So, what is it? There's three rights: the right to be, the right to habitat. Vermont, didn't you guys just have a big fight about a nuclear plant? And Vermont said no. The federal government said yes. The right to be, the right to your habitat, because that's what that fight was about, habitat, wasn't it? That's a fight about habitat. And you're saying, no, that injures my life and my well-being to activate that, and that's a danger we don't want to deal with. But there it is. We're in that fight. And then the right to unfold, the right of whatever inclinations you have to move out from you and out so that your voice is heard and has meaning in the community. To me, that, I mean, it's just all powerful, but that one. To watch a child and to see the child's inclinations and to nurture those inclinations so that those inclinations can mature. What a gift and an honor to participate in life that way. As opposed to, I need to raise my son in a way that he can survive in this culture. And he's going to have certain skills in this culture, and I'm going to make sure he has those skills, or he's not going to be able to survive and make enough money to live. As soon as I have that, am I starting to chop off what it means for him to be a human being? But at the same time, he's going to college, he's going to do this, he's going to do that. So I'm looking at the inclinations and trying to nurture them, but at the same time, I'm saying, you can't think that way. That's not going to work in this world. That won't work. You're going to have to do something different. And then we fight, and he cries. Sometimes I win, and sometimes I don't. That's how it works. We chop our own children to be conformed to this culture. And we know it's true. It happens. Earth spirituality. How do I loosen my mind, as the poets would say, you have to loose your mind. How do I do that? Well, I go in the woods and I sit on the tent deck and I look at the flowers and all of a sudden the flower moves through me. Now I've got a ritual. And I'm going to do it with all the different colors of all the flowers and see if different colors feel differently. Will red feel different than yellow? Will green feel different? But I would never have done that that for the last several years I haven't been thinking about what does earth spirituality mean? What does it mean for me to be a part of a system and that as I make a decision I need to include that whole system? Include it in such a way that's life-affirming, not include it in such a way that is it of use to me, but to participate in this planet in such a way that's life-affirming to myself, to my family, to my community, to the animals that are around me, to hear footsteps at night in that tent, I'm thinking, is there a bear out there? So I don't know, you know, it's, how do you come to that balance? Because there are bears in the woods out there. You know, so you have to be real. So how do I do that? And so how do I put myself, as that poem says, I'm beginning to love the earth. How do I mature that? How do I grow up in that? How 13.7, 57 years, 13.7 billion. How do I grow up the rest of my years and mature as earth spirituality being a core of my value system? That's the question. How do I do it? And am I free enough to let that unfold as that third right is? Whatever that might mean for me. Because things will change. My attachments will change. Maybe no attachments. My life will shift. And am I free enough with myself to say, let's take that journey. Let's find out who I will become and who we will